Okay, so today is the 5th of March, the 11th of Adar, and we're going to do Purim 5772. So the first question is, what are we celebrating? And I think, you know, there's that joke that all the Jewish holidays are, they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat.
Let's eat.
However.
This one sort of.
Well, this one fits that bill, and so we might think that that's what we're celebrating. And the Hanukkah fits it, and Pesach fits it. The rest, of course, don't. So I was thinking about Pesach and Hanukkah are, I guess, the most celebrated of the Jewish holidays, and so one might think that that's the theme, but in fact, of course, it's not. Mm-hmm. But it seems like that's what we're celebrating here, is the fact that we were saved from a genocide. And it's interesting to think about. Esther Wien pointed out that we all know the story of Purim. I'm not going to cover that. And we all know also that a concept in ancient Persia was that when a decree was sent out by the king, it couldn't be rescinded. Another one could be sent out. But the decree to kill the Jews couldn't be rescinded. They had to send out a decree to kill the anti-Semites.
Which is why, right? In the end, the decree wasn't rescinded.
Right, so it seems that the decree wasn't rescinded, meaning it's still there. Which is why we still see death threats coming from that place. Because the decree wasn't rescinded from that place. So it might seem then, especially in the light of that, that what we're celebrating is the fact that they didn't win and that we're still here and that they're still wishing. Mm. However, I think I would like to go deeper than that this time. So we have the concept that Purim will last forever. Of all the holidays, it's the only one that's going to stick around
after
Mashiach comes. So why is that? What is so important about Purim? What's so deep about Purim that it's going to be here even after everything, that we're not going to need. It even says that of the Sifrei Tanakh, of the 24 books of the Tanakh, after Mashiach comes, all we're going to need is the 5 books and Esther.
And wasn't Esther almost not included? Wasn't there a controversy about including Esther or not?
Oh, I'm not aware of that. Hashem's name is not included
in it.
Right,
which is why there was a controversy.
About Esther?
Because if there's no Hashem,
why should there
be
Esther? Well, Mordechai is all over the place. I mean, Mordechai, it's interesting, and I don't have the answer to this yet because I'm still in the middle of Rabbi David Foreman's book, The Queen You Thought You Knew, which I recommend because I love David Foreman. So he says, what's up with the Mordechai veneration in the book? Not that Mordechai is not a good guy and not that he didn't do good things, but why are the verses that we say out loud about Mordechai? You know, when we start reading the Megillah, we right away say, you know, we talk about Mordechai and it ends with
Mordechai.
And everybody's happy with Mordechai, that he's still the second to the king and everybody's happy with him. Who cares? Right? I don't have an answer to that. Sorry. Just a question.
<Good job.
laughs> I want to leave you with questions. All right. So for that, you'll have to read Rabbi David Foreman's book. But we do know that Purim will last forever, and that's what I want to try to access today, is why will Purim last forever? So we can start by looking at the name of the holiday, name of the Megillah, not the name of the holiday, which David Foreman looks at, the name of the holiday. Why call it Purim, which is lots, which is totally antithetical to what we feel about how history is run, that it's not that Haman cast lots to see when he should kill the Jews, leaving our fate to chance. Right? If he's casting lots, what he wanted to say, and he cast lots not just to see when he should kill the Jews, but also to terrorize them, it says in the Megillah, lahumam, to make them scared. So the idea was, how would he make them scared? By saying, your fate is not in anybody's hands.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's taking care of you. Mm. It's up to the winds of chance, and I'm going to cast lots and just see when you're going to die. So why should the book be named? Why should the holiday be named that, right? When it's actually the very opposite that we understand. But let's look at what's
also called Megillah Esther. Oh, the holiday though.
The holiday is important,
right? The book is
Megillah. So what we're going to talk about is Megillah Esther. That Megillah Esther is about Megillah, which means scroll, also means to reveal. Legalot is to reveal something, and Esther, as we know, is hidden. So it's the revelation of that which is hidden. That's what Megillah Esther is. So, and it's fascinating to think about when we have these questions, the Talmud asks where people are found in the Torah. If they're important, they must be in the Torah somewhere. So, Haman, the Torah minayin, where is Haman found in the Torah? So the answer is, and it can seem like a stretch in certain places, it seems like that here, except for that you'll see it's not a stretch. Where is Haman found in the Torah? he's found in the question that Hashem asks Adam, Hamin ha'etz achalta? Did you eat from the tree? Hamin ha'etz, so that hey mem nun is how you spell Haman, right? So different, so it means from the tree, from the, or Haman, right? So that's where we see Haman. So how is he must then be related to the Eitz Hadas, to the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which is what messed up everything, right? Eating that is what messed up everything. And so we see that he's the root of everything being messed up. That he really comes from putting doubt into our hearts and confusing our senses and making things less clear. That's who Haman is.
All the way from there to Ahmadinejad.
Right. Right. All the way from there to Ahmadinejad. That it is one pathway, that we are all wondering. So that's one of the things that I brought back from Israel this time. Also, I really felt there was a difference. And yes, religious Jews have been hopeful about the redemption for a long time. But I really felt like now it's like crackling in the air. You can feel it. Like, and there is more excitement. Now, it's possible that's just maybe among the ecstatic, you know, super from few. And that's mostly who I hang out with. So maybe that's what it is. But there certainly is the worry about the threat coming from Persia. Mm-hmm. And that's a significant threat. Mm-hmm. And Netanyahu is speaking with Obama today, and he should be a good shaliach for the Jewish people. But it's just interesting to think, you know, the people are, this is the difference between now and earlier times in history when people were excited about the Geula, is that today everybody agrees that we're Erev Mashiach. All the rabbinic
presences. Like when else was it thought to maybe be Erev Mashiach?
So there were times, so it's interesting, I shouldn't say that. I mean, one time that people, that a lot of people agreed was Shabtai Tzvi.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right. He was, perhaps.
Yeah, that, he for sure was Mashiach.
I mean, they thought.
But that's a time that people really, I mean, a third of European Jewry actually sold their stuff and was ready to follow him.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine a third?
No.
Your friends
gave
and neighbors,
up their house.
Yeah, gave up their houses, had their stuff in barrels at the ports, waiting for the call. Basically, had lifts assembled, waiting for the call to get on the ship with their stuff and go. Yeah, and so people were living with other people, you know, in-laws living with their kids who live near port cities, waiting for the call. So.
What year is this? In like the
1690s or something like that. Let's see, 16. In the 1600s, mid-16s.
That's really
late
recent.
16s, yeah, it's it is really
yeah,
recent.
It is really
I thought
recent.
It was 11, 12 years.
Mm-mm. Oh, yeah, no, so it's pretty recent, actually. I mean, it's interesting to think the book, I'm sure you've read at this point in your life, The Memoirs of Gluckel of Hamelin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was written during that time. Her in-laws had their stuff in barrels at the port.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so she's writing, actually, during that time. And during that time, there are many... there was printing then. Mm-hmm. There's already the printing press. So,
right.
One of the things that would often be printed in the beginning of a siddur or a chumash was a page of Shabtai Tzvi's like this, and it said Yechi Melech HaMashiach Shabtai Tzvi. Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. So.
And he just basically disappeared. I mean, right? Like.
He converted to Islam.
Yeah.
Fortunately, he had a very good publicist at the time who was able to convince people that that was just a move to test the faithful to see if they'll still believe in him, even though he's doing something that looks like it's wrong. But it's not really. Keep the faith. And, yeah, and people kept the faith. And then he died,
right.
And people still kept the faith. Yeah. Which is one reason why the Ramchal, which we're going to look at his writing soon, one reason why the Ramchal got into such trouble shortly thereafter. He lived about 50 years after Shabtai Tzvi's death.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about it, think about how close we are to the Holocaust, right? Mm-hmm. We're still touching it.
Oh, yeah.
It's still real in our lives, even though we were born after it.
Yeah.
It's still very, very present. So Shabtai Tzvi was still very, very present in the lives of the Jews at the time of the Ramchal. So when the Ramchal started to write and was being taught by a malach or Eliyahu HaNavi, and he was very open about that, I mean, in his letters, not like he was broadcasting it to the world, but he was clear he was being taught from sources most people don't learn from. And he was revealing things in ways that hadn't been revealed before. maybe not material that hadn't been revealed, but in ways that made it understandable. So that's why people, that, you know, in terms of charismatic leadership, everybody was very nervous. So that's why his books were banned, and he was put in chayrim, and off he had to go from Italy to Amsterdam. So hindsight gives us the ability to understand that the Ramchal is mainstream Jewish philosophy at this point. He's no longer controversial, even though his books were very questionable at the time. But that is mainstream Jewish philosophy. And we know very clearly Shabtai Tzvi had nothing to him at all. I mean, hindsight also tells us that very, very clearly. There's just nothing to
him. He was really a fraud.
Right, really a fraud. In a way, it's sort of like Lahavdil, but similarly like communism. You know, 50 years ago, there were plenty of Jews who really thought there was something to it. If not really bought into it, but at least were open to the possibility of a value in it. You know, and today we see so clearly nothing. It's just absolutely obvious, but only with the hindsight. So it does take some time sometimes to evaluate those things. So the question is, why will Purim last forever? What is it about this holiday that's a permanent holiday? So it's so easy for it to be obscured in the costumes, which is part of it, the obscuring, in the costumes and the drinking and the gifts and the all that stuff. But what is it? What are we really trying to access here? So one way to look at what we're trying to access is to try to look at the mitzvahs of the day. So trying to think if that would help us. And probably I don't know enough to go into the depth of the mitzvahs to really get there, but there is certainly a theme among them. So the four mitzvot of the day, Matanot Le'Avyonim, Mishloach Manot, Seudah, and Megillah. So Megillah is hearing the story, and Pirsumei Nisa, which we'll get to, publicizing of the miracle. The Seudah is about creating connections between people, and that's one of the things I was working on. I'm doing some work in my Inner Torah workshop. We're working on boundaries and how do we establish and maintain boundaries. So I realized for myself, one of my personal ways of establishing and maintaining boundaries is creating little mantras for myself. So I was thinking, how can I work with the whole food thing that I'm doing to establish and maintain a boundary? I want to create something that works for me, a mantra. So I said, kosher, kesher, kind. That's what the food needs to be. So first it has to be kosher, has to follow halacha, has to create a kesher, whether it's between me and myself, me and Hashem, or me and other people that I'm sharing food with, right? Create a kesher. And then kind, that the food should be kind. So I was trying to think, what could I have as a food rule that wouldn't say no sweets, no sugar, no nothing, right? I want to be kind to myself, which means in general, very healthy food. That's what's kind. But that does leave some room for chocolate occasionally.
Dark
when
chocolate.
It's kind. Yeah. When it's kind. But then you have to evaluate, is that being kind or is it not being kind? You know, there's the Yesh Gvul. Right.
Yeah.
Right, Yesh Gvul.
Yeah.
So, and it also allows room for there to be kindness, even let's say if there's something I wouldn't want to eat, but I'm the guest of somebody who would really like me to eat that thing. So there could be kindness there too.
Even if you know how much olive oil is in the potatoes.
Right, right. Or worse yet, how much Rich's Whip is in the mousse. You know? That kind of thing. But you could still have a bite because you want to be kind. So Seudah is about connection with other people. Right. It's about celebrating. And it's about creating connection with other people at the table through food. Mishloach Manot is about sending gifts to people that we like, sometimes to people that we don't like too. It's a great way to create repair in relationships, but it's a great way to strengthen relationships with people that we appreciate and enjoy and our neighbors. The way that we do it today, sending to everybody, is a little over the top and not fully necessary. We do want to create expressions of appreciating people around us, and we also want to make sure, the Rambam says that we should be, if we're going to increase in one of the mitzvahs, it should be in Matanot Le'Avyonim, not in Mishloach Manot. So that's why we have, for instance, the Tom Chai Shabbos cards and those kinds of things,
so that you can buy and send that.
So that way you can, at the same time you say you're thinking of somebody, you're actually increasing in the charity as opposed to in the gift giving. So and the Matanot Le'Avyonim is, of course, taking responsibility for the people in our neighborhood and the people in our lives, and giving to those who need as a responsibility. It's separate from tzedakah. Now, it's interesting that...
separate from tzedakah. So it's like the doing rather than the giving?
Right, so it's the exercising on that day. There's no limit in Matanot Le'Avyonim, as far as I understand. There is with tzedakah. You're not supposed to give more than 20% of your income. That's the max for tzedakah. So there's a max. Apparently with these, there's not a maximum. But so with Matanot Le'Avinim, it really is about feeling that actual connection on that day. So it's, again, that's what I'm saying. I don't really understand the depth of these mitzvot. But what we could see from the mitzvot is, so the main theme in the first three is the connection, connecting with others, being connected. And the last one is the revelation of the miracle. And then we have these two customs underneath, the drinking and the costumes. Drinking, a very strong custom, mostly for men, is not a custom for women in general. So I heard Rabbi Berkowitz speak about it, and he was pretty clear about that, that also costumes in general are not for women. They're for children and men, but it's not considered necessarily modest or becovedic or dignified for a woman to wear a costume. And I think that's community dependent. I really do.
It's interesting because I sent out that email last mm-hmm. night about one of the people on the list was Evelyn Livesey, and her thought that she sent back to me was that the costume is a way for us to sort of just cover ourselves up in something that's obviously not typical and allow our inner self to come through, allow us to be more jubilant, more... Mm-hmm.
Or the child self, or the...
Less inhibited. Uh-huh. And I like that, because I always get the kids dressed up, right. And Ari's always dressed up ridiculously, and,
right.
You know, and I'm always just like, okay, I'm wearing my regular clothes, and I'm behaving my regular self, and I'm thinking, like, maybe that's a good idea, maybe that's, you know...
I think there is something,
and that made, but,
right.
You know,
there is a custom actually to dress up as non-Jews,
what?
Which so it's an interesting
that's
custom,
so interesting.
And we'll see why.
Like tank tops and short skirts.
No, not necessarily. But
not
you know,
today.
But like, let's say instead of dressing up as Mordechai as Haman. Or instead of Esther, as Vashti.
Yeah,
Or if you're going to pick, you know, so then pick a non-Jewish, you know, you could dress up as Martin Luther King too, if you want. But there is an idea to dress up as non-Jews, which we'll see in a bit why. So the concept of all of this, really, and the drinking and the costumes is, we'll see what that's about. But really what I want to look at today and why I brought this piece of the Ramchal is about the concept of Gilui Yehudo. So I wanted to do, and I'm glad it's us in this class, so we have a little more background, because that's required for this piece of Ramchal. This is from the Das Tfunus, and it's just interesting to learn. I'm learning this with Rabbi Edelstein, Avram Edelstein. We have a phone chabura from around the world, different women in Ner Le'Eleth, so it's interesting to learn it with him. So the Das Tfunus, the way the Ramchal wrote, apparently, and I'm still a student of this, so I'm not speaking with authority, I'm just quoting my teacher, is that the first book of the Ramchal, you could see it as concentric circles. So the first book, or the approach to his philosophy, would be Mesilas Yesharim, Path of the Just. And then comes Derech Hashem. So those are both books that I've learned in Derech Hashem, currently teaching, and that I base a lot of what I teach in underlying philosophy on Derech Hashem. But Das Tfunus comes...
You did that in only 3 years.
Right. I think it was four.
Actually. 4 years.
Yeah, 4 years. But then comes
Das
Tfunus.
Fast. We love
this. So Das Tfunus is stepping inside a little further.
What does
so
Tfunus mean?
Tfunus?
Understanding. Tfunot. It's with a bet. Tevuna. Tevunot.
Taf bet.
Taf bet. Above, yeah. Dat Tvunot. So, and he has one, this book that he calls Dat Tvunot, and then there's more writings that's been named not by him, but Dat Tvunot Bet. So that's an additional thing. And then past that would be the Kalach Pischei Chachma, the 148 gates of openings of wisdom, Kalach 138.
So did he write in Amsterdam?
Yes, he continued writing there. He continued writing there. And he was very young. He died at 38.
Oh my gosh.
So he wrote
Mozart.
He wrote a ton, yeah. I know. Now that you're in your 30s, 38 seems really young, right? It's very young. It's extremely young. So when he was in Padua, Italy, and he was put into Chayrim and his books were burned, he accepted the Chayrim. The Chayrim, he had a special Chayrim that he was not permitted to study Kabbalah until he was 40
and
living
stuck.
In the land of Israel. So at 38, he and his family moved from Italy to Amsterdam where he lived and he did write there. And then whenever he went, if he went at 36 or 37, he lived in Akko, Israel, and at 38, he and his entire family died in a plague. Yeah.
So he never got to study.
So I personally, and I don't know if others share my view, but my personal guess is that Rabbi Arya Kaplan is his reincarnation, you know, and a similar kind of thing. I was able to really reach depths and write it in ways that were very accessible. So he was an excellent translator of the deeper concepts into language that we could understand. And also he was taken relatively young.
Right.
He was 48, not 38, Arya Kaplan, I think. Still very young.
Yeah.
You know what? In that day, and compared to the times, those 10 years were about the same.
Yeah, probably.
You look at life
Life expectancies, right? Yeah. Right. So here we are now in the dust, who knows, with that little introduction. I guess I'll introduce just drop more. So according to the philosophy of the Ramchal and Derech Hashem. Hi, welcome.
Hi.
Glad to see you.
Glad to see you.
Here you go. We're just about to do this Hebrew page. So I printed it large so that you could try to translate underneath.
Thank you.
If you want to write. Okay, so the Das Tfunos is written in a question-answer form with the soul questioning the Seichel, and the Seichel explaining things to the soul. So the way that it's written is Amra HaNeshama Amar HaSeichel. Right? The Neshama asks, the Seichel answers. So this is an answer of the Seichel that we're going to look at.
Okay.
So the Neshama is really wondering, what's the purpose? So we understood in Derech Hashem that the purpose of the world, of all creation, is to
connect with Hashem.
Right, connect with Hashem so that we can receive Hashem's goodness. Hashem wants to give us goodness. And so in order for Hashem to give us goodness, he created a world in which we could choose to connect or disconnect. And to the extent that we connect, we create ourselves into the receptive vessel to receive Hashem's goodness. We receive as much good, basically, as we shape ourselves to be able to receive. Right? So, and that's all through free will. The primary mechanism is free will, that Hashem has to move his will out of the way in order for our free will to exist. And so he does, because otherwise his will would dominate ours. So just like Hashem, so to speak, moved himself out of the way for the physical world to exist, he also moved his will out of the way for our free will to be able to exist. And part of emulating Hashem is then us in turn, the way Hashem made space for us, that we make space for him in our lives. So there's that. So that's basically the philosophy that Derech Hashem shares. And so the question is then, why does there need to be Mashiach? With that plan, if that's what we understand, is that the world is created as an arena for our free will to be exercised within, and that the whole point is for us to work on ourselves, to create, move ourselves in the direction of being able to receive as much Hashem as possible, then why does it ever have to change? Right? If it was good enough for our grandparents, our great-grandparents, if it was good enough for Moshe Rabbeinu, right, why are we looking towards a future that's different than the past? Right? So do you hear the question? So that's the question of the Neshama, right? So now the Seichel is going to answer that. Now, I have to say, it's a very long answer. I'm just doing one paragraph here. Really, the book is about that.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's about a lot of things that go with that, but to understand it, you know, it's quite a big thing. So, but we are going to look at this paragraph and just set this up in terms of how it relates to Purim. Okay? So, Amar HaSeichel. Okay, aval hamaase mochiach sheyichud hu haomed lehitgalot. Okay, well, let me read this first part on top. Hayichud yitgale al. Let's see. What's that? I know that. Vehabichirati patel. Al kolpanim. The yichud, the oneness of Hashem will become revealed, even though al kolpanim, no matter what, Hashem's oneness will be revealed. I'm in the little letters on top. V'habechira tit batel, and free choice will be nullified. Zemochiach sheikar briat hara levivor hayichud. This proves that the root of the creation of evil is for the clarity of the oneness. So he's saying here, the whole purpose of the creation of evil is the more evil there is, the easier it is to see the oneness once it's revealed. Right?
The more evil there is, the easier it is to see
the oneness once it's revealed. Right? So the idea, I mean, also sometimes stated as on the background of darkness, it's easier to see the light. Mm-hmm. Right? But this is a little deeper than that, actually. It's not just that light is easier to see on a dark background, but that it's saying here that the proof, it proves that the root of evil is for the clarity of the oneness. And the whole purpose really is the revelation of Hashem's oneness. So, and that is different than us becoming the kli to receive Hashem, the vessel to receive Hashem. So we've talked about before that we Jews have a dual purpose. That's perfect ourselves and perfect the world. Right? So what's the perfect the world about? So you could see it on the lower level, which would be more the Derech Hashem level, of there's the reciprocal relationship that as we perfect ourselves, through perfecting the world, we perfect ourselves. Through perfecting ourselves, we perfect the world, because we are connected to the whole world. So the more that we perfect ourselves, the more we create an energy of perfection that flows into the world, and the more that we work on the world, the more we exercise ourselves through working on the world and become rarefied ourselves. So that there is this relationship that goes back and forth. But this is even deeper than that. Okay, so all right, so now let's read this Hebrew. Okay. Aval ha-ma'aseh mochiach sha-hayichud hu ha-omed lehitgalot. But the behavior proves that this oneness is waiting to be revealed. Ha-omed lehitgalot. It's waiting, it's standing there ready to be revealed. So in behind all the machinations of history, the oneness of Hashem is right there waiting to be revealed. Ki anachnu ro'im, because we see, the promises of the prophets, shehavunam lamala kvar, that we already brought earlier, asher hu mavtichim, that they promised, shehakadosh baruch hu yigael et Yisrael, that Hashem will redeem Israel al kol panim, no matter what. Now, the question is, afilu below zchut, al kol panim, that what, no matter what. Okay. Al kol panim. It's an expression, it means on every face.
Face, yeah.
But al kol panim is an expression that means no matter what.
Okay.
No matter what. Afilu below zchut, even if we don't merit it, even if we don't generate the merit. So even if we misuse our free will, collectively, as a nation and individually, each and every one of us, it would be possible, according just to the lower level that we discussed earlier, it would be possible to bankrupt Hashem's plan. Right? If Hashem created the world in order to give us good, and then he created us with free will, it would be possible for us collectively to ruin it for Hashem, because we could all choose bad, and then he would not be able to give good, right? If we have free will. So it's saying that the plan is actually deeper than that, that Hashem will reveal his oneness, and he will be giving good to everybody, no matter what. No matter what, afilu below zchut, even without merit. V'sheyasir yetzar hara, that's the Rosh HaTevot here, he will take away the yetzar hara, mivnei ha'adam, from people, v'yachricham la'avdo, and he'll force them to serve him. V'hine kol elahem neged haschar v'onish v'neged ha'bechira, and behold, all of this is against schar v'onish, reward and punishment, and against free will. So this runs completely counter to everything that we've learned in philosophy so far, right? Which is already a step up from what we learned in school earlier, right?
So Hashem will take away the Yetzer Hara in the time of Mashiach?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So Hashem's going to take away the Yetzer Hara. So there's going to be a transitional period.
Mm-hmm.
So the time of Mashiach, it's just going to be different. Or it could be Olam Haba. But that's, so it doesn't really matter, but the point is it's going to be taken away, right? V'im ha'ita ha'kavana be'emet la'ha'amid inyan ha'bechira v'ha'schar v'onash, and if it was Hashem's true intent, be'emet, true intent, la'ha'amid inyan ha'bechira, to cause to stand the idea of bechira, of free will, v'ha'schar v'onash, and reward and punishment, dehainu she'yeh ha'olam tamid banui mivnei bechira, that is to say that this world would always be built of people who have free will, mm-hmm. b'nei b'chira, mm-hmm. right? Be quiet.
Talking to your children again.
Oh my goodness.
Must be done.
Lihiyot tzadikim o rasha'im kirtzonam, that every single person who would be a baal bechira, a ben bechira, would be able to choose to be a tzaddik or a rasha according to their will. Vatamid yihye tov letzadikim, and there would always be good for tzadikim, or ra l'rasha'im, or bad for the rasha'im. Hayat zarich shezeh yihye tmidi, it would be necessary for that to be forever. Oh, come on. I just have to turn this off, sorry. Let's see if I can figure out how to do that.
New phone.
iPhone?
No.
It's a new phone, though, huh?
Yeah. Okay, let's just make it go away. I think that'll do. Oh, maybe not. Whatever. Okay. Where did we go here? Good. Okay, that it should be forever. Velo yeh lo hafsek, and it should be that there's no break in that. Right? It should be that that's the way
that
the world is set up. If that's what the kavana was. Vze haya, and that's what it was. Sheh kadosh baruch hu haya rotze lehachzik b'midat ha-mishpat, and that Hashem wants to strengthen the mida of mishpat, the trait of judgment, of law, really, of law, of everything going according to the, you know, cause and effect the way it's supposed to be. La'amid kol briyato bo kol hayamim, to keep his people in that, all his creation should be in that cause and effect judgment all the days. Aval, but, zeyadanu she'eno kach. Now, we know that it's not that way. So this all comes from before. The way that we proved from the sources, mikorot, from the biblical sources, of kemuvu aralano v'divrei chazal, and the way that it's clarified for us in the words of the sages. Shesof kol sof, in the end of all things, tasur ha-bechira min ha-adam, the free will will be taken away from the person, v'lo yiyu od ra'ot ba'olam, and there will no longer be evil in the world. V'kvar amarnu, and we already said in Brachot Yud, Daf Aleph, yitamu chataim min ha'aretz kativ. Yitamu, they will finish. Finished will be the sins from the earth, it is written. So there will no longer be sins, there will no longer be negativity. Im kein, ein sof hakavana al haschar va'onesh. If that's the case, then the end of the purpose, the whole point of it, is not schar va'onesh. Ella ha'al hatikun ha'klali. The whole point of the thing is not the scharva onish system, that we should enter into it with our free will, that we should create ourselves into something that can receive the schar, or that will get the onish, but rather the whole point is the tikun klali, the whole perfection of the entire thing. The tikun ha'klali, which we're going to discuss. Aval, Shehir kiva kadosh baruch hu, rather, shehir kiva kadosh baruch hu shnei hadvarim ke echad. Rather, Hashem wove these two things together. Shehir kiv, he put them together, hakadosh baruch hu, Hashem, shnei hadvarim, these two things ke echad, as one. Vahaya ze, me'omik etzato lisavev hakol al hatikun hashalem. And this is from the depths of his advices, Eitzato, Lisovev Hakol al Hatikun Hashalem, to stir everything into one. Lisovev is to turn, but to like weave everything together into the Tikun Hashalem. Va'od Nidaber,
Tikun Hashalem,
the
peace.
Complete Shalem is whole, the complete perfection, the complete repairing. We're still going to talk about this as the book goes on, right, with heavenly assistance. When we get to the details of the behavior, because this is a very deep and fundamental principle. Okay, so this principle of the revelation of everything, that everything is really moving towards the revelation of oneness. So that's what I want to bring here, is to show you this. The whole point here is to say that there is something besides just our own selves that we're trying to perfect, that it's not just about us and our choices, that in the end we will arrive at the destination that Hashem has chosen for us, which is for us to receive goodness. Now, I heard Esther Wien speak, and she pointed out that the pasuk of Asuli Mikdash Vishachanti Bitochem, you should make for me a mikdash and I will dwell among you. right? Not I will dwell in it, but I will dwell among you, that by engaging in the building of the Mikdash, you will be creating inside yourselves a place for me to dwell, that it's in a command form. Va'asuli Mikdash, v'shachant b'tocham. It's not an option. You will make for me a Mikdash, and I will live among you. It doesn't matter what you choose. I will be there. I'm living inside you. Right? So now let's get back to Megillah for a minute, and let's look at Haman. Right? Haman thinks he so chose to be out of Hashem's plan. He cast the lots. I could care less about Hashem. He doesn't run anything. It's all run by chance, right? And yet he's the one who set up everything. It's because of his choices and what he did that Esther came to the throne. It's because his choices and what he did that that he was hung on his own gallows. He got to choose if he was going to make the gallows or not, but he didn't get to choose who was hung on them, right? And he's the one who elevated Mordechai, and he's the one who led him through the streets. Like, he did it all, right? So Hashem used him to reveal goodness in the world. Even though he did bad things, he was still part of the plan. Oh, no. Go away, fire alarm. We don't believe that it's anything, so...
No, we don't. I believe it's the construction people that have set it.
We definitely don't want that. So if somebody knocks on the door and tells us to go, we will.
Or if anybody else moves.
Otherwise, we're going to pretend that it's not ringing.
Haman will... I just lost.
So, okay, so the idea here is that...
Oh, that he couldn't... I got it.
That it wasn't up to him.
Right.
We do get to choose our behavior, but we do not get to choose the results. Right, so we get to choose what we will be engaging in, and we get schar and onesh. We get reward and punishment based on the choices that we make. So we do get to choose how we behave, but we do not get to choose the results of that behavior.
That's the old, why do bad things happen to good people?
Well, that's not really, because it's a deeper thing. That's a deeper concept. Why does that happen? And that's really about schar and onesh and how the world works and the revelation of Hashem's oneness. It's all wrapped up in that. But if you want to like bring that point into one sentence, that would be the sentence of lo alecha hamlacha ligmor. It's not upon you to finish the work. But you can't stop from doing it. So it's not up to you what the results are. Up to you is how you engage in the process, right? So you have to continue to engage in the process no matter what the results are. You don't have to worry about the results. I mean, that happens a lot of times. I'll get a phone call from somebody on some campus, right? And this woman will tell me how she can't possibly take a break, take a vacation, cut her hours back. She's having a hard time running her house, taking care of her kids because there are so many kids on campus that need her so much. And they're going to assimilate if she doesn't live with them. So, and I just have to remind her, lo alecha hamlacha ligmor. Don't think for a minute that it's up to you if these kids assimilate or not. Your job is to run your family, raise your children, support your husband, and if you have some discretionary time, then invest it in Kol Yisrael. But don't take away from your actual, because you don't know what the result is going to be. Right? It's not up to you. It's up to Hashem. He gets to decide, and they also get to decide. A lot of people forget that other people are Baalei Bechira. Other people have free will, too. It's not like any one of those college students doesn't have computer access, and they can't look up aish.com if they're not curious about something. I mean, really, you know, let them take a little responsibility for their lives.
Go find the local Kabbalah.
I mean, really. So they're finding them. These are campus Kiruv people. So, but you still can draw your boundaries and understand that it's not your job to finish the work. You can't finish the work. The work is unfinishable, but it is your job to invest in trying. And you have to then always know what's your first avoda and what comes after that. What's your first job to do and what comes after that. So, but it turns out that Hashem will reveal himself in the world, whether or not you choose to be the instrument of that revelation. But for sure the revelation will come. So you could choose to be part, you could choose not to be part, but it's still going to happen through you. It'll happen in different ways depending on your choices, but for sure it will happen, right? But Asuli Mikdash, you're going to build for me a Mikdash. It's not an option. Hashem's just letting us know what his plan is. You're going to build that Mikdash, and I'm going to live among you, period, end of discussion, right? No matter what you choose, that's happening. So that's why
we look... like your mother-in-law, not yours. When one's mother-in-law says.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's happening. So that's what Hashem is saying here in this, and that's what the Ramchal is saying about Hashem here in this Das Tfinis that we looked at, is that it doesn't matter if we don't, in the end, if we don't build the schus, if we don't build the merit for Hashem's revelation. Hashem is going to reveal himself and reveal the oneness. And the whole purpose of evil on the lower level that we looked at when we looked at Derech Hashem, the purpose of evil is to create the ability to make choices, right? So that we have the ability to choose this or choose that. It's interesting, I also learned from, what's this, Esther Wien? It depends on who. I was listening to so many classes. I think this is from Rabbi Edelstein, actually. That first Adam creature that was du partzufim, two faces, mm-hmm. right before it was divided. So one of the things about that two-faced creature, and I don't mean two-faced in the negative way, mm-hmm. just two mm-hmm. that had two faces, was that there was no back. It was connected at the back. The back, Kabbalistically, is considered the negative side. That's where waste exits. Mm. And the front is considered the positive side. So with no back, it meant there was no chisaron. There was no negative aspect to that creature. It was all positive. And with no negative, then you have no ability to create tikkun, to fix, and to work towards positivity. So in the past, we've discussed that in terms of not being able to give, that the creature wasn't able to emulate Hashem in the givingness of Hashem, because if all creatures were going to be whole mm-hmm. creatures, what would you be giving to? What meaningful giving would there be? So there needed to be the division in order to create the space for giving. People needed to be missing pieces so that others could give, right? So they could be the vehicle of others' goodness. But here it's actually a different thing. It's also that what we said before is true, and also the fact that if there is no negative possibility, there's no positive possibility, right. really, either, that you can't work towards the positive if there's nothing negative to work through. And so we needed that. But that it's only there as a means to an end. It's not there permanently. It's not there because it has a place in creation in the end. In the end, it doesn't. In the end, it's going to be the revelation of Hashem's oneness. Now, negativity helps reveal Hashem's oneness, which is... I mean, I think a lot of Jews could get mad at this, and without understanding this very deeply, it is a place where people can get stuck and say, how mean is Hashem?
Yeah.
You know, because you could easily say...
That's a Holocaust question.
It is a Holocaust question, but forget the Holocaust. I mean, the Holocaust is after the Inquisition, is after the Chmielnytsky massacres, is after the Crusades. It's one thing after another, after another, after another. Right, so I mean, in a way, I think a legitimate question that many people could ask without all this deeper understanding is, how mean is Hashem? You know, that he has to show that he's with us by
creating tests.
By creating tests. You can see, any student of history can look back in history at this point with all that's happened to the Jews and say, it's clearly, undeniably miraculous that the Jews still exist today. Nobody can say it's not miraculous. Nobody. Because we've been so vilified and so kicked out and so scattered and so poor and so torn apart and so beaten in every country and so massacred century after century after century after country after country after country that there's just no way that we should still exist. And the fact that we came back to the land and created a blossoming land out of a dead desert, how could it possibly... It's clearly miraculous. There's nobody who can deny it. Even a secular person has to say, whoa, that's really interesting. You know, like anybody who's actually looking has to say it's a pretty amazing thing. But it's only amazing because it was so hard. Right? It wouldn't be amazing. It wouldn't be amazing if everybody would have said, wow, the Jews are really great. Whoever blesses the Jews are blessed through them. We want the Jews in our land. And if everybody was vying for us to come, so we got scattered around the world because everybody was offering Jews, please come and live in our land. Please, we love you.
Mm-hmm. And you're a blessing among us.
Right, and so we were scattered throughout the earth because people were calling us and pulling us and treating us so nicely everywhere we went. And they said, we'll give you the top spots in the universities and the government because we love you and we think you're fabulous. And everywhere we went,
all the land you want.
We were completely venerated and taken care of and coddled and protected and empowered. Then nobody would say, well, it's obviously you're still around today. It's no great shakes at all. I mean, it'd be a little bit interesting because we are, you know, outlast other nations, but everybody would say, well, look, everybody understands that you have the Midas touch. No matter what society you go, so obviously everybody wants you. So that's why you're still here today, right? It's only in the face of the negativity that you can so clearly see that Hashem is absolutely with us the whole time. And yet it requires the fact that we suffer so so much the whole time. So it's a very difficult thing to understand, and I'm not saying I can fully explain that. However, there's this concept that in the end, it's only because of all that that it will be so completely obvious that Hashem was there the whole time. It's only because of all this negativity. So that in the end, as Yemales Chok Pinu, right, that we say in Shir HaMalot, in the end, then our mouths will become full of laughter. Because it'll be like Purim, full of laughter, that we'll turn around and we'll say, oh, now I get it. I can't believe it. Oh, it's amazing. And we'll be laughing. We'll be laughing at the Holocaust. We'll be laughing at the Inquisition. We will so get it. We'll so see it that our mouths will be full of laughter. It'll be that twist that's in humor, what makes something funny. Not that it's funny that people suffered, but that ability to see it so clearly and see that Hashem was totally guiding the whole thing, 100%, even though we thought he was missing from the scene, right? Our mouths will be so full of laughter at the time when we totally get it.
That's which will be when the Mashiach comes.
Well, yeah, we're starting to see it now. I mean, and I think that it's possible that even today,